For the week of April 28th, 2013, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 189, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
Finally back in Los Angeles.
Well, you know, I had to travel. Do you want to introduce yourself, though?
Oh, and in New York, I'm Michael Gill.
So, yes, Michael, I am back in Los Angeles after 2 weeks on the road, one for CinemaCon, and then I swung by on the way back, traveled through the Mojave Desert to a little tiny get-together out there in Indio, a little kind of music thing.
I think to punish you for not doing a show for 2 weeks, you shouldn't get to talk about Coachella and CinemaCon.
Oh, okay. So then nothing happened over the last 2 weeks.
Thank you for
listening.
Well, what did happen was that George Jones died, the voice of country music. Funnily enough, I realize now how little known he is outside the world of country music. Do you know him at all?
On the grounds that I might incriminate myself, I'm going to take the fifth and
okay,
say,
yeah.
Who's George Jones?
Yeah, he's not quite like Willie Nelson or a crossover person that a lot of people outside country music know. He's just been the voice of country music for 50 years. He has just a classic baritone country voice. If you're familiar with Randy Travis, who's now, I guess, an old legend now himself, he's sort of in the vein of George Jones. You know, I mean, Hank Williams is the iconic country artist, Patsy Cline. George Jones as a singer is right up there with them. He's just a huge figure. If you've never heard him, go to YouTube and play The Grand Tour or He Stopped Loving Her Today. Those are two gems by George Jones, and that's just as country gets.
Of course, George Jones passed away over the weekend during Stagecoach. Well, he wasn't at Stagecoach, but Stagecoach is the country music festival that takes place after Coachella in the same venue at the Empire Polo Fields out there in Indio. And some of the locals were telling me that it is just a scene of mass debauchery and wildness and craziness. Sure enough, 3 days, one weekend, there were something like 150 arrests. And over 2 weekends of Coachella, 121 arrests.
Well, that's not so different. What is it?
No, 6 days, 120 arrests versus 3 days and 150 arrests.
So 150% more arrests,
given the time frame. Yes.
Well, all right. And a lot more hats.
Most of them cowboy.
What are we going to talk about this week?
Okay, well, yeah, we probably should kind of move on. Well, first of all, I'd like to thank our listeners because they certainly were concerned that we didn't have an episode not only last week, but the week before. Of course, we did.
Follow us on Twitter or Facebook because we'll tell you.
Right, and I wish I knew Raul's last name or at least how to pronounce it. I want to say it's Burial or Burial. He has been posting news stories to our Facebook page, which we will be covering here. At least some of them we'll be covering here. And I should kind of say up front, Andrew Einsbrook of Wild Pure Heart Productions and I are now Andrew is a listener. We're going to be trying to schedule a meetup in Cannes. So I don't know whether it'll work out. I think it probably will. So if you're going to be attending Cannes and you are listening to this show right now, let us know dirt@showbizsandbox.com and we'll try and get everybody together. And of course, our Facebook page is facebook.com/showbizsandbox. But you asked Michael on today's show, so let me get to that. We'll be talking about everything that happened at CinemaCon in Las Vegas. I guess it was a week or so ago, or, you know, we'll touch on some of the stuff that happened there. That includes, by the way, a big fight between North American movie theater chains and Disney, again, because if you remember, they had a big fight about Alice in Wonderland a couple years ago. And, you know, really, this is all about the studios trying to increase profits and lower their costs. We'll explain what that means. We'll also talk about, as you just mentioned, Michael, the Coachella Music Festival, which I was lucky enough to attend. We'll tell you which bands created the biggest buzz and what the mood was like out in the desert this year. Netflix has turned their ship around with both subscribers and revenue up. Investors are now clamoring for the stock, and CEO Reed Hastings is feeling so good, he released a manifesto about the future of television. Spoiler alert, apparently it won't be happening on cable or broadcast networks. We'll close with some inside baseball about China, and more China. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office, not from North America, but from around the world.
That's right. And the number one movie around the world, even though it hasn't opened up yet in the U.S., is Iron Man 3, starring Robert Downey Jr. It opened to a massive $195 million around the world. We'll have a lot more to say about that in a minute. Number two around the world is Oblivion, the Tom Cruise film, which opened while we were away. It has now made a total of $263 million worldwide. It grossed $30 million around the world this weekend. It's already made a lot more than the last Tom Cruise film, Jack Reacher, even though it's only been out for 2 weeks. Jack Reacher made about $215 million. This is at $263 and counting. So Tom Cruise is still a movie star. At number three, this is the number one film in North America. It's Pain and Gain, a tiny little film by Michael Bay, starring Mark Wahlberg. It grossed $20 million. At number four is the animated film The Croods, another success story for DreamWorks Animation. That made about $20 million around the world. It's at $471 million and counting. So it will hit a half a billion dollars any day now. At number five around the world, G.I. Joe Retaliation, another $13 million. That's at $350 million worldwide. And number six, who knows if it'll open overseas? It's about baseball and a black man. So it's about the two things that people around the world care least about. But it's 42, the very successful film about Jackie Robinson. It grossed another $10 million. It's at $70 million and counting for a film that cost about $40 million in its budget.
And I should say, before we get a ton of email about your comment right there, I think what you really are trying to say is, hey, nobody outside the U.S. cares about baseball, or at least very few people do.
And black people, and films about black people. They often don't even open up overseas. Tyler Perry is a huge success story in the U.S. His films don't even get released overseas. Hollywood historically has resisted films about and starring black people because they claim that people around the world won't watch them. Of course, you have big stars like Will Smith and Denzel Washington, which prove them wrong all the time. But most movies, unless they're by absolute huge superstars, they don't even bother to show them. So a movie about a black person, it just is very hard to get it shown overseas. I think it's Hollywood's problem as much as the rest of the world, but it's what happened. It isn't easy to get them shown in North America either. They're not clamoring to make a lot of movies about minorities, but it does happen. It is successful. But the fact that it's also about baseball, that really puts the kibosh on it. So it'll be interesting to see if it even opens up in other territories. At number seven around the world is Scary Movie 5, another $10 million for the franchise. It's at $40 million and counting. And number eight, another movie that's opened up in North America alone, it's The Big Wedding, a romantic comedy. Topher Grace is in this all-star cast. It opened to a very weak $7.5 million. At nine, the White House is Under Attack film Olympus Has Fallen. That's $7 million it made around the world. It's at $123 million and counting. At number 10, a French comedy called Les Profs, the teachers, I guess. That's made another $3.8 million. It's at $14 million and counting. In limited release in North America, though it's opened a little bit stronger now. It's The Place Beyond the Pines. That made $3.8 million. That's at $31 million and counting. That's a very good showing for an independent film like that. Its budget was $15 million, so it's doubled its budget so far. That's great news for it. Down at number 13 is Jurassic Park. That's made $50 million worldwide. I guess I have to eat crow on that one. I thought they would be lucky to break even, but they've made decent amount of money on that. Though it's a toss-up whether that's really helping the film or, you know, showing there's not that much interest worldwide when you add it all up. And finally, in limited release in North America is Mud. That is at number 11. It didn't quite break into the top 10, but it's from the director of Take Shelter and
It's number 11 in North America.
In North America, right. Yes. It grossed $2.1 million, so it had a nice solid opening weekend for that nice solid film.
And worldwide, number 12 was Evil Dead. I noticed you skipped that. I don't know whether you have a kind of something against Sam Raimi remakes.
Remakes, I do have something against them. Movie that's dropped out of the worldwide box office charts, it could go back in again. I don't know if it's opened in China or Japan or what the deal is. But Oz the Great and Powerful, that's perhaps close to the end of its run. It's always hard for us to keep track of every territory that it has or has not opened up in. But this movie cost $215 million. Right. And, of course, they had a huge worldwide ad campaign. That had to be, what, $100 million, $150 million at least?
Oh, easily $100 million worldwide.
Right. It has grossed $480 million. So if you add the ad budget and the total cost to make the movie, you're at well over $300 million, $350 million. Is this a success story? Is this a bomb?
Well, I think it's a success story, and here's why. Here's why I'll say it's a success story.
What?
I think if you can break even on a big movie like this and
But I don't think they have yet. They're not close. They need to gross $600 million, $700 million to break even, right? And they get what, but 30% of overseas grosses?
No. I mean, overseas grosses are the same as, we'll be talking about that.
What studios get back is about what, 30%?
No.
From overseas? No. Oh, no. Is it 50% still?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. It depends on the deals that are cut. I mean, Django
Unchained. I thought they tended to get less.
Well, it depends on the territory.
Okay.
But, you know, here, look, if they can squeak out a narrow loss or a break even out of this film.
That's good, yes. But would they make another one?
Oh, I don't know if they need to make another one because they have.
Well, they wanted to. They thought they were launching a franchise. Well, so the question is, do you make a sequel to Oz if you hit $600 million, do you pull the trigger?
I think you wait to see how you do on home video.
All right.
You wait to see how it does at the theme parks. And if there's something there, then you go and make a sequel.
Good point. Good point. How much did people pay to see Oz the Great and Powerful?
Well, apparently a little bit less because the National Association of Theater Owners, who put on CinemaCon, which is this convention in Las Vegas for a week.
Used to be known as Show West, and I don't know why they changed the name.
Well, I can tell you why they changed the name. National Association of Theater Owners owned the trade show. They gave it to Nielsen to run for 10 years.
Oh, right.
And they said, okay, look, you run it for 10 years, and so they basically sold it to Nielsen. But then it got so expensive and it was being run for profit and people were just very unhappy. So NATO said, look, we'll take it back. And Nielsen said, okay, fine, except you can't have the name. And so now it's called CinemaCon instead of Show West.
And what did they say about ticket prices?
Well, NATO said, hey, guess what? Ticket prices are dropping, at least in the first quarter they are. And well, just a little, actually. They're not dropping a whole heck of a lot.
And there were almost no 3D films released in the first quarter that were of a big note. So therefore, other than Oz the Great and Powerful, so that may have something to do with it.
Well, and I guess the films that were released in 3D were children's films, so there may have been more matinee tickets sold, and that's one reason why ticket prices dropped in North America from an average of $8.05 in the fourth quarter to, I guess, it dropped down to $7.94 in the first quarter.
And believe me, for them, that's not good news. They don't like it when ticket prices drop. They like to pretend they think it's good news. Oh, hey, everybody be happy. But for them, that's actually a bad sign.
Yeah, and I guess last year we reached that record high of $8.12. Again, average ticket price, the ATP. That is not the effective ticket price, what I like to call the effective ticket price, which is how much people are paying. It's a weighted average.
Right. In New York, yeah. You're paying $12, $15, $18, depending on the film and whether it's in 3D or IMAX.
Right. I mean, basically, if there's a theater out there, let's say it's in Fargo, North Dakota, and their ticket price is $5 and only two people purchase that ticket and go see a movie there. But in Los Angeles or New York, ticket prices are $12 and 40,000 people purchase tickets there. It doesn't matter. $12, $5, you add them together, you divide them by two. That's your average ticket price. I mean, it makes no sense.
So that's a ridiculous way to get an average to estimate what ticket prices are.
Well. But
that's terrible economics, terrible statistics. Is that really how they do it?
That is
absurd.
Exactly how they do it.
That is awesome. That's so they can hide how expensive ticket prices really are.
Yeah, I didn't say that.
There's no other reason. There's no other reason for doing that.
Absolutely.
That's ridiculous on a statistical level.
That is
absurd.
Correct.
If you sell a million copies of a ticket at $15 and one copy of a ticket at $5, you would not say the average price is $10.
You know, it's funny because I was having this argument.
It's funny because it's a lie.
I was having this same argument at CinemaCon, and there was
not an argument. They're wrong. That's absurd. You can't go to any statistics professor, economics person, and say, how would you estimate what ticket prices are in North America, what people actually pay? That's a ridiculous fake estimate. I had no idea that's what they were doing.
Well, don't you think, I mean, there's that old saying, there's lies, damn lies, and statistics?
Couldn't agree more.
Right. Well, so, you know, one of the things that happened at CinemaCon, which is effectively every movie theater owner in the country and sometimes the world. I mean, there are people there from Russia and from China and from Latin America and even Africa.
What did you do while you were there? Were you just attending panels and discussions or were you working?
I was working and attending panels and discussions. I was doing all of the above. Seeing films. Okay. I saw The Heat, which stars Melissa McCarthy and Sandra Bullock, a kind of a buddy cop movie, which was very funny. Saw parts of Star Trek, Monsters University, which I think you didn't like the idea of a prequel to that movie, right?
Oh, I'm not a big fan of Monsters, Inc., so I'm not exactly excited for a prequel, no.
Yeah, I'd hold on to that thought if I were you.
Okay, I'm seeing Iron Man 3 tonight.
Ooh, okay. Well, that they didn't really show, everybody expected that to be shown there. Disney did not show that. They did announce a couple of other things like, hey, we want, a Star Trek movie every year. They're thinking of trying to do a Star Trek.
Star Wars.
Yeah, you know what? I'll go with Star Wars for 300. Yeah, no, they want a Star Wars movie every year. But the thing with Iron Man is there was this big dispute happening at the time between AMC, which is one of the world's biggest movie theater chains here in North America. Wanda, a Chinese movie theater chain, purchased AMC last year. And Regal, the world's largest movie theater chain, based in Knoxville, Tennessee, they were having a little, well, I don't want to say argument, let's call it a dispute, let's call it a debate, over the shares of the tickets for Iron Man 3. And they were having this argument with Disney.
Put that in English. You would think that studios had a standard agreement with movie theater chains, but they don't. They renegotiate for every single film. Is that right?
Yeah, they do kind of have a standing rental contract, but...
Right, but whenever they want to, they can step in and say, this movie's different. So with Iron Man 3, they said, hey, normally we take 50% or 55% of the box office gross in that first weekend. Now we want 65%.
Well, and for the most part, they're not doing what's called a 90-10 deal, which it's very complicated and I'm not going to get into it. But they're effectively saying we want an aggregate. So instead of it being 65% the first weekend, 60%
right.
the second.
I always thought that was stupid. Yeah.
Yeah.
Then you got to worry about how big a movie is going to open. It should just be a percentage of the total gross.
Right. And so instead what they're doing is they are saying, look, we want 65%. You know, and this is a not a rumor, but reports say they want it between 60 and 65% aggregate all weeks.
Which is a massive increase over 50 to 55%.
Right. I can tell you that there were some exhibitors that for Iron Man 2 paid between 60 and 63%. I know that for a fact.
Wow.
So, I think that those exhibitors who were smaller, I will admit, probably didn't balk at 65%. However, AMC and Regal, what you're seeing now is these movie theater chains in North America are getting as big as the studios and they're beginning to push back.
So what happened?
So what happened was there was this big standoff. And by the way, Disney, the way they do this, not to not answer your question, but Disney has this whole sliding scale thing. So it's 65% if the national gross reaches a certain point, and if it doesn't, then it goes back down to 63%. It's this whole...
Fair. Well, that's good. You know, if they're saying if it's a flop, we're not going to take a big chunk of a flop.
Exactly.
That's nice. Yeah.
Yeah. And so they kind of went back and forth, and apparently the second that AMC and Regal pulled advanced tickets from being sold from Fandango and all the web ticketing companies. And
they said, we don't want your movie. Never mind. We're not going to sell tickets. Forget it.
Right. And Disney, 1 week later, I guess they reached an agreement. I don't know what it is. We'll never know what it is since that's confidential. But I can guarantee you it's not 65%. It's probably less.
So they've pushed and they've gotten away with it with smaller chains. Do you think that's the future? That, again, when you've got a big movie people want, do you think they'll eventually cave and need that movie?
I think they're...
Where does the power lie right now? If you've got the next Star Wars movie, are they more interested in making sure they don't cave on cut, or do they really want that film? Do they really want The Avengers 2, or are they going to hold fast? Iron Man 3 is a big movie. That was a big one to play tough on.
That's very, very true.
It wasn't exactly Oz the Great and Powerful, where you didn't know what you were going to get.
Right, no, and that's why AMC and Regal kind of did push back.
Because... Well, no, but I'm saying that shows guts on their part, because this is a movie they really wanted.
That's right. That's absolutely true. Now, mind you, AMC and Regal, you're talking about 12,000 screens right there. There's 38,000 in the U.S., so that's a big chunk of screens. Those theaters open movies. Without those theaters, you take a huge hit. And so Jerry Lopez, who used to be at Starbucks and has been the head of AMC for, I guess, the last two to three years, he said that we've been surprised at the ask. So I thought that was a very interesting and
he can't even believe that Disney asked for 65%.
Right. Says the,
all right.
The depth and breadth of the ask puts us in a very, very uncomfortable situation. Clearly, they are under some kind of financial pressure. And he was talking, this is Jerry Lopez, the head of AMC, talking to the LA Times.
He's mocking Disney, saying, oh, they must really need the money.
Well, everybody knows that they basically, and I've talked to some of the people who were made redundant there, who were laid off. They laid off like 120 employees there at Disney in distribution and at the studio, not at the theme parks, but at the studio.
How many employees do they have overall at the studio?
Oh, I think thousands. I don't know, but they, and you know, some of the people who were laid off who were at CinemaCon said, look, you know, we understand in some instances, we understand why they're merging jobs or moving positions. It makes perfect sense. In other areas, we think they're losing some talent.
Right.
To save money. You know, they basically lost their DVD revenue and lost their home video revenue.
DVD is what, $10, $12 billion a year? $18 billion a year last year. Let's not say lost. It's bigger than the box office. They act like, oh, we don't get anything from DVD. They get $18 billion a year in North America. $18 billion, and you're acting like, oh my God, they've lost it. It's all gone. It's 80% bigger than the box office.
Well, I'd have to go back and look. I don't know. I don't have the
figures. We reported it last week. It was $18 billion. That's not exactly pennies.
Well, $18 billion,
and they're like, oh, we're making nothing from DVD. They never want to pretend they make a penny from DVD. When it was hand over fist, they just never even mentioned it. And now that it's falling a little bit back to normal levels, they're like, oh my God, DVD's collapsed. We can't pay you anything.
Well,
would you
think
mind
about
freelancing
it
for us?
If you're the key buyer, if you are a key buyer, which is...
I'm just saying it's bold to say, oh my God, they've lost DVD. $18 billion a year is not lost.
Well, I think what they're also trying to do always, and they're always trying to do this, is, you know, if you're the key buyer and there's only six buyers in a market, everybody's going to be coming to you with their hand out. So if you're constantly crying poor, people will know, well, my hand's out, but I know not to expect too much.
No, unless you're an idiot and realize they're not poor. Richie Rich can't pretend to be poor. He lives in a mansion.
Well, but
look at the pay that they get at the top of Disney.
Is he upside down on the mansion? Does he own more than it's worth?
What are the salaries for the CEO of Disney? $50 an hour? I don't think so.
No, I think it's a little bit higher than that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, when he's, you know, making six figures rather than seven, we can talk. Or six figures rather than eight, I should say.
Okay, well, I know that you had something very interesting about, you said something in our pre-show about Iron Man, which when I took a step back, I went, oh, that's actually true.
Well, Iron Man, I think, is sort of, Iron Man 3 just embodies a lot of things going on in the film industry right now, if you look at it. Number one, you've got the ever-changing fight between studios and distributors. They're all trying to make their money.
Wait a second, studios and distributors are the same people. You mean exhibitors and distributors.
Studios and exhibitors, I beg your pardon.
Yes.
That's why I don't get invited to CinemaCon.
I don't know that you're... well, never mind.
Number two, of course, they cast Chinese actors in cameo roles in the film because they want to get official distribution in China. Only, you know, a couple dozen movies get shown in China. They want to make that money. They want to get in there. They also want to get more money out of China. So that constant back and forth with China where you're trying to curry favor and also get a piece of that ever-growing pie, Iron Man 3, you know, is part of that. It was released in 4DX in Japan. And a number of other countries. What the heck is 4DX? It's a stupid, stupid format where not only do you get a big screen, not only do you get great sound, you have an immersive experience. And I'm making air quotes while I say that. Your chair tilts, it vibrates. There are strobe lights and odors and fog and even bubbles pouring down from the ceiling. The effects are programmed for a specific film being shown. You know, they're not random. They do it to whatever the big scenes of the movie are. There are 4DX theaters already operating in China, of course, South Korea, Thailand, Mexico, Israel, and a number of countries in South America. They're hoping to come to the U.S. this year. Avatar was the very first film given the 4D treatment, and you won't be surprised that ticket prices are double the regular price when you see a movie in 4D.
Right. Well, and in the U.S., there's a... this is called motion seats. That's basically what
I remember this from the 70s when Earthquake came out. It was sense surround and the seat vibrated during the earthquake. Ooh, if I want a theme park ride, I'm going to go to a theme park. It's a movie.
Yeah, you know, it's D-Box here in the United States. I remember in 2006, they came to DTS. They had like this trailer that they were pulling and they put us in these recliners.
I hope you laughed at them. I hope you got out and laughed at them and said, good luck with that.
I said, well, you know, I can see for the video gaming experience, I could see it. I don't know about this whole movie theater experience that you're going for, but they've proven incredibly popular on movies.
Not
like
incredibly popular.
No, well, I mean,
I've never heard of them.
D-Box?
D-Box, never heard of them. How many theaters are they in? Are they in New York City? Never heard of them.
I think
I've never been in
a
movie where the seat vibrated since the 1970s.
Well, no, they are in certain theaters, and even in those theaters, they're only in certain rows, so usually toward the back.
Oh, God.
And those seats, you know, the tickets cost a little bit more. And I did see Fast and Furious. I don't even remember which one. I think the last one. And it actually, only that film, because I've seen a couple films that way, and that was the only time where I thought, huh, this is actually pretty cool.
But how many theaters are they in North America?
Oh, dozens. I don't know.
Which is nothing.
I'd have to go. I mean, look from 2006 when they were in none to now. I mean, mm-hmm. They certainly have grown. Let's put it that way. They're based out of Montreal.
Still an experiment. You can't. I mean, if you can add up the theaters on two hands, it's not exactly a lot.
Okay. Well, hold on a second. I'll tell you. I don't know.
When you look at that, I'll say another thing that Iron Man 3 embodies is this. It hasn't even been done before. It's a kind of a bold new thing where they've got multiple films with multiple actors, and then they bring them together in a big film, and then they split off again into sequels for the franchise, and then bring them back together. And the whole Marvel world, their approach to the Marvel world with Iron Man and Thor and Captain America, and then you get the Avengers, and then you get more sequels to all these other movies and spinoffs, and then you bring them back. This has never been done before to this level. It's unbelievable. And Iron Man 3, of course, Iron Man 1 and 2 were no slouch. But Iron Man 3 is playing like a sequel to The Avengers. I mean, they're now saying, is this going to open bigger than The Avengers in North America? It's really jaw-dropping what they've done with this. And it's not going to necessarily work for every film. How will Captain America do? How will Thor do? That'll be the real test of this synergy. But if they can just keep making these sequels and they're pretty popular, and then they make another Avengers and it's one of the biggest films of all time, I mean, this is a really amazing thing. And you can bet dollars to donuts Disney's planning to do the same exact thing with the Star Wars universe. You know, they're going to throw up Boba Fett. They're going to throw up everything you can think of and then bring them together into big movies and just keep going one a year. Absolutely. And Warner Brothers is killing themselves. They can't make this happen with the DC world. They want to. They'd like to, but it's tricky.
Well, and finally, certainly, I have to say, Disney really has, they know what to do. They know how to do this. They know how to play this
game. Well, they didn't do this. It was other people that started before Disney. They don't get credit. Don't give them credit. They can maintain it. Good power to them, but they didn't start this idea.
No, not at all.
Right. So they don't get credit. They've never done it. No one's ever done it before. They've taken over. They're doing really well with this film, and they did great with the Avengers, but this started before them. So credit to the people at Marvel for making it happen. And finally, anyone who tells you stars don't matter, who stars in Iron Man 3? Who makes a ton of money off this movie in the Avengers? Robert Downey Jr. Do you want to see Iron Man without Robert Downey Jr.? Maybe not for 20 years. I mean, he really made that first film happen. He shows the power of a celebrity, of a star in the right role.
Well, just to answer your question, it looks here that there were 146 new D-Box systems installed in the first quarter of 2013. So,
and anyone who pays for them is a fool. And I include both the exhibitors and the people buying tickets.
Wow. Well,
thank you very much.
Thank you and good night. Drops microphone, walks off stage. Well, yeah, okay.
But they're trying to make money every way they can. The studios are trying to lower their costs and increase profits, which brings us to our next section.
Which I don't even know where we are anymore because I was spending so much time looking up how many D-Box screens there were.
Well, we're talking about studios and Iron Man 3, how it symbolized the industry. And of course, the industry as a whole wants to lower costs and make a bit more profits. And the studios have lowered costs of their movies, or at least the costs that they're reporting to us are definitely markedly lower. Sometimes they're paying the stars a bigger cut of the gross and pretending that their budgets are lower because they don't include the salary of the star because they're going to give them first dollar gross. And they're playing lots of tricks, but they are clearly trying to lower the cost of the money that they spend on movies, not their big tentpole films. Those are going to be big. They're going to be $150, $200 million. There's no getting around it. But for a lot of their movies, they are trying to lower their costs. Variety did a report. They had a market analyst look at an in-depth look at major studios and how they're making money. And they claimed several trends, none of which will surprise listeners of Showbiz Sandbox. One, studios have lowered their costs. How did they do it? Well, they ended a lot of pricey producer deals. They're making fewer films. They're making smarter deals with stars so that the budget is technically lower and they're risking less money. It means they'll make less money when the movie comes out, but that's okay.
Okay.
Number two, international box office keeps exploding.
Right.
Which, of course, you're going to make more money if you've got more people buying tickets. And that's why studios are focused on big tentpole films that will travel well. The $200 million movie is more important than ever.
Okay.
Home entertainment revenue has stabilized. The new normal is $18 billion a year in North America, with the drop in DVD made up for by video on demand, which was $2 billion in 2012, and video streaming, which was $2.3 billion. And of course, those are all growing. So $18 billion a year, not pennies. Oh my God, we're broke. Give me a break. Number four, Variety says studios have reversed the quote-unquote long-term slide in admissions, with admissions rising in 2012 for the first time since 2009. They have ignored the fact, of course, that 2009 was the highest year of all time for box office admissions.
Admissions or not admissions.
Ticket sales.
Yes.
Right. That's the same thing, isn't it?
No. Box office gross. Sorry. Box office gross, not ticket sales. Fewer people going.
No.
Higher.
No. Ticket sales were at a record high in 2009. And they dropped technically from that record high in 2010 and 11. But they were still among the five highest ticket sales of all time. So, I mean, they say, oh, my God, this long-term slide of 2 years. They're ignoring the fact that those 2 years include some of the most ticket sales they've ever had in history. So they just have no perspective. They're like, they think every year should be a growing increase in ticket sales, which is stupid.
You know who might not have any perspective?
Who?
CEOs.
Why not?
Well, because I think they, as you point out here in our show notes, they're making a bit of change. Now, we talked about how DreamWorks was lowering their costs. They're going to China, right? Which mm-hmm. we're going to be talking about during, you know, Inside Baseball. So we won't talk about that here. But DreamWorks said, oh, we're cutting 400, 500 people and we've got to lower costs. The one cost we don't have to lower is, let's see. Oh, the CEO's pay.
What did Jeffrey Katzenberg get?
I have no idea. I guess it increased more than 30%. And I don't know, what was it? Like, I think
he made about $10 million in 2012.
Okay, yeah, that's, wow, that's buried here. Okay, $10 million in 20, and Daly's compensation went up from $3 million to $4.6 million.
A nice 50% increase in your package.
Right, she's a chief operating officer over there.
Mm-hmm. And $4.6 million is known as chump change among some of the people, like Les Moonves. Of CBS. Where is he at? CBS. What did he make? He made $58 million in 2010, $70 million in 2011, and $62 million in 2012. That's $190 million in 3 years.
Well, let me just tell you something. Those mansions in Bel Air don't clean themselves, okay? And
no,
that's especially true.
He has to find illegal immigrants to do it for him.
No. Look, that is especially true when you come in on Sunday evening from the mansion out in Malibu, and you're dragging sand through the place, okay?
Now, CBS stock was up 40% last year. They had record revenue, record operating income, record earnings per share. So maybe he's paid too little. It's done better than the Standard & Poor's 500 for four consecutive years. It's the number one network and audience, and has growing profits in new markets. So maybe he's paid too little.
Wow. Okay. Well, if
he's... Or maybe he's paid too much because it's a publicly traded company. And surely they can find someone else to do the job for, say, I don't know, $90 million rather than $190 million.
Well, you know, you got to keep up with the Joneses.
The CEO of Discovery, David Zaslav, if I'm saying his name right,
I don't know.
$50 million. By the way, we're rounding that figure up because he made $49.9 million, which is like you're buying a used car or something. It's $14.99. It's like he made $50 million, people. $49.9 million is not something to, you know, give me a break.
Well, you know, I actually found out this was kind of public knowledge when he was hired, but Chris Dodd, the senator, who is now the head of the MPAA, he makes mm-hmm. like between $2 and $3 million a year. And he's part of a trade group.
Well, yeah, and they said, well, you can't possibly get something done if you don't pay big money. They all, you know, all their friends are on the boards. They all hire each other, and there you go. So they fire employees, make them freelance, move jobs overseas, and give themselves raises.
Right.
I feel like a communist.
No, come on. Don't be so hard on yourself. If anything, you're a socialist.
That's right. So now, for a social event, you had Coachella, which you went to. What was your experience like this year?
Very social, as a matter of fact. Funny you should mention that. Well, you know, I don't know how many years I've been going to this thing. I mean, it started in 99. I went to that one. Then I guess there were so many people that overdosed on ecstasy. They had so many arrests and problems that they took 2000
off. Yeah,
stop
picking on the country fans. All they did was drink beer.
Yeah, a lot of it, apparently. And so they skipped a year in 2000, then 2001. And I remember the days when it could take 3 hours to drive the 2 miles from the freeway, the I-10, all the way to the Empire Polo Field, a whopping 2 miles. It would take 3 hours. Because
why didn't you walk?
Well, you know, some people started to do that. The problem was that it was just not built to have 80,000 people show up at once. So
Sure. There
was one dirt road in, and by dirt, I mean, it was like, you know, pretty much gravel and, you know, unpaved road toward the end. But now they've really fixed the place up, the Empire Polo Fields where the event takes place. And they have that down to a science, getting the crowds in, getting the crowds out. Yeah, there are a few hiccups here and there. But I attended the second weekend, not the first weekend. So, you know, I guess A lot of people felt like, hey, the music sounded better on the second weekend, but the vibe was better on the first weekend. And I think to a large degree, that's partly due to you're creating this festival atmosphere and trying to create these unique, special experiences. And then all of a sudden, they're trying to recreate it the next weekend all over again with the same exact bands in the same exact time slots, except for one. And it just, it's kind of like, how do you capture that in a bottle and then release it again?
It's just like touring though. I mean, what's the difference between seeing Springsteen in New York versus Minneapolis or say, you know, the first night of a stand in Jersey versus the fourth night? I mean, it's just catch as catch can. Isn't it just as likely the second weekend would have been better?
No, not really. The second weekend doesn't get as much press. So for instance,
oh, well, if the press isn't there,
well, let me ask you this. Did you hear, last year, we had, who was it? It was Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And they had the 3D hologram of Tupac. Now, they did that twice, but did you hear about it the second time? No, you heard it about it the first time. So that's what I mean, is like once it's done.
Well, there aren't many surprises like that, surely. It's the music.
Right. And the
music. What was your favorite music of the whole weekend?
Well, okay. Before we get to my favorite music, I must say this is the third time Grizzly Bear was there in the desert at Coachella. Still haven't seen him.
What do you got against Grizzly Bear?
Nothing. It's just they're always up against somebody good. So they're good, but I'm always like, oh, I'd rather see this other band.
maybe they'll come to your house and play a little set for you.
Major Lazer, big draw. Didn't go see them, but everybody seemed to love them.
I want to hear about what you saw and what you liked.
Well, I saw a portion of Monsters and Men. They were nice. 2 Chainz, everybody loved. Okay, so who did I see that I loved? Portugal the Man.
And that's a good group.
Yeah, I thought they were from Europe. Yeah, no, they're from Alaska. Didn't know that. Two Door Cinema Club.
Oh, my nephews in Alabama love Two Door Cinema Club. They've been pushing them for years.
They are fantastic.
Great live act, huh? I didn't know that.
And I saw them there a couple of years ago. And part of the problem with Coachella is they are in April, so they're a little early. And everybody's like, hey, our new album's out in like 3 weeks. So you don't know any of these new songs that we're about to sing. And band after band after band this year was like that. You had the Yeah, Yeah, Yeahs that had that problem.
Now, they're always great on television. And it's not easy to be a good live act on television. You go on the late night talk shows, Letterman, Leno, etc. It's not an easy thing, and the Yeah, Yeah, Yeahs are always really good. I've never seen them in concert, though. How were they?
Well, I saw them a couple years ago. I think it was 2009, and when I saw them before, ironically, the release of their last album, I thought, wow, they played at like 5:30. I said, that is a headline act right there. The next time they're here, they're going to be a headliner. Well, they weren't a headliner. They were playing on Friday. They played right before Blur and the Stone Roses,
yeah,
who swapped. They were one.
Yeah, nobody cared except people. I mean, I don't know why that was even a story. Who cares?
It's not a story. But they were unbelievable. They were fantastic, the Yeah, Yeah, Yeahs. They know how to put on a show, and they are
That's what I've heard. They're a thunderous live act.
Yes, and she is just, she knows what she's doing. What can I say? And, you know, she wears the kooky outfits, Karen O, the lead singer. It's only 3 people in the band. And they know what they're doing.
Very cool.
Another group that hasn't been around for 10 years, and their album, again, not out, Postal Service. And this is the Ben Gibbard of the Death Cab for Cutie and some producer whose name I forget. They kind of teamed up by mail. They did all their songs by mail on the first album. It was a big hit. And now they have the second album coming out. Jenny Lewis showed up from Rilo Kiley. And of course, that band broke up. But she came to play keyboard and guitar and sing with Ben Gibbard there. They were fantastic. They were one of the headliners on Saturday night.
Very cool. Lumineers is a band. They're sort of very much in the vein of Mumford & Sons. And my friend can't stop playing their album. I've heard it 100 times. You would think for some reason, well, they're an acoustic sort of band. You know, they're playing guitars and it feels like they're on your front porch singing. So for some reason, I always assume that those type of bands will be better live. How did they do?
They did actually playing late afternoon. So like 5 o'clock-ish. On Sunday, so people were already pretty tired, and I thought, oh, God, this is not going to be good. They're on this big, giant main stage. There's 3 of them. It's just not going to work. Totally worked. They sounded great. People were totally into it, and they sound fantastic. So then they're about to walk off stage, and somebody runs out and whispers in the lead singer's ear, and he goes, oh, we have a chance to play one more song, apparently. We still have time. Let's play one more song. They start playing, and halfway through the song, they pull the power to the... And they continued, and the crowd was on the Lumineers' side saying, you know, hey, they continued to sing without the mics. It was a great, and that's what I mean. That's a great moment. Unrepeatable. Yeah. And I think, quite honestly, I felt bad for them because they were ready to walk off stage. And somebody came and told them.
It's just a little snafu.
Yeah. Phoenix, they were the headliner on Saturday night on the main stage. I'm not quite sure they're a headliner. I still don't think, you know, they sounded great, but as a headliner, I don't know. I mean,
they certainly haven't broken out.
No, I mean, they
either
have,
creatively or commercially, I don't think. I mean, they've had some very good music, but they haven't become a major artist either creatively or commercially.
You know, Hot Chip was there again, this time on the big stage. They were okay. I think the stage was a little bit too big for them. Passion Pit was there. Their second album came out last year. You know what? Just a little off. I don't know why, but the energy on a big stage just it didn't get captured. Beach House played against the Yeah.
Uh-huh. And well, then you didn't see them.
No, I did. I did. Lots of running around.
Okay.
And they were fantastic. They sounded great. What I would suggest for them next time, light yourselves, okay? This backlighting, there's no need for it. I mean, they backlit themselves the whole time. It could have been me up there on stage. Nobody knew.
But your biggest act, the one that really blew you away,
was probably Portugal the Man.
Oh, not Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds?
Oh, yes. No, I have to say, thank you for reminding me of that. So Sunday, it kind of leads up to this crescendo. Lumineers, then Vampire Weekend on the main stage, and they're always pretty good. Again, their album hasn't come out yet. Then Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, and everybody who's there is there mostly to see the band that's after Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds on the main stage, and that's the Red Hot Chili Peppers, the headliner on Sunday night. And let me tell you,
I'd rather see Nick Cave, frankly.
Holy, he is not for the faint of heart. I mean, this is a guy that literally has albums called Murder Ballads.
Oh, yeah, that's a great album.
And so he just basically came out on stage. He's got two people in the Bad Seeds that look like they could be axe murderers. Okay, so I mean,
they're not. Yeah, they're more of a biker gang type of rock group.
Oh my god! And it's actually pretty decent music. And he crawled out into the crowd and on. And it's not easy to do that at Coachella either because they have all these like barriers. And he's basically not crowd surfing, but like barrier surfing. And he's screaming, and people were just. I mean, I think there were some people that were just emotionally traumatized after seeing that show.
So not to complain, because of course you want crowds to be able to get in and out easily. You don't want to be stuck in traffic for hours just to get a mile or two. But is Coachella so smoothly running now, so professional, that it feels a little like a Disney park ride?
A little bit. And I don't mean to complain. It is one place where you can go. I mean, listen to all the bands that I've seen. I mean, Jessie Ware, she sounded great. Bat for Lashes was great. Alt-J, big indie act right now. Sounded great, absolutely no stage presence. I mean, all of these bands. And Rodriguez from Searching for Sugarman.
Ah, how was he? Did you see him?
I saw him. He came out. He had to be let out because, you know, he's kind of blind. He's got guacamole? No, he's got glaucoma.
Glaucoma? I didn't know that.
Yeah, and so he's not totally blind, but you know, his eyesight's not great. So he had somebody tune the guitar for him, like the other guitarist would tune the guitar. He comes out. And he stands there in front of the audience. Tame Impala is playing on the outdoor stage, and he's kind of in the Gobi tent. He's waiting for them to stop playing so he can play.
Yeah.
And I was like, hey, you know, I don't think they're going to stop. I think that's, you know, so he played. He sounded good, but, you know, it wasn't as, I don't know, just, I don't know. It was
so
good.
The festival overall.
The festival overall.
A little too professional?
Yeah, a little too professional, a little bit too. Not that I'm complaining about that. I guess I just look at it and go, maybe I'm older. I don't know.
That's true.
But it's backbreaking. It's hard to continue doing these festivals. And
As a fan,
it's becoming harder and harder to continue going to these festivals, having to shell out a fortune to go. And you wonder, like, wow, is it really worth it? Should I not just go see a show at a small club? Because, you know, the headliners...
I'm all about the small clubs.
And the headliners, I mean, the Red Hot Chili Peppers, Blur and the Stone Roses, I didn't even go see. Didn't care. Because it was Friday, I was exhausted. Red Hot Chili Peppers, I saw, they were okay. They're always okay. Didn't really care. I cared more about the bands that were on in the middle of the day than I did about these big headliner acts. But the Coachella is and Golden Voice, the promoter of the festival, is trying to get all these VIP tickets. Which are 700 and some odd dollars now, and they're trying to push that over into the four-digit category. And I have to say, this year, if you had a VIP ticket, they had a section right by the stage that they cordoned off just for you. It was worth it this year. In years past, all it was yeah, you get to go to that special bar that's only for VIPs.
Well, big deal.
Big deal. The bar is really far away from the stages.
And pay tons of money for a beer.
Yeah, exactly. Who cares? But now, they have these little cordoned off areas next to the stage. It's really well worth paying the VIP if you have the money. You're right up front. And you don't have to be there all day trying to get to the front of the
crowd. Right. It's limited and you're always guaranteed to get in there.
Yeah. I mean, it was, but you know what? It's
so the rich get the 1% enjoys the show even more.
Yeah. I mean, and it is, I don't know. I mean, I looked around and I just went, wow, it makes me feel old. And I'm only in my early 40s. It's really making me feel old.
Well, I'll tell you what made me feel sad was seeing Rolling Stone cover the festival, and somebody made fun of this. Rolling Stone Village Voice had a piece on Coachella, and it was a slideshow of like the hottest chicks at Coachella.
I have to
say, oh my God.
That has become an annual trend after
that. That is embarrassing.
Everybody does
it. That's embarrassing. The Village Voice. Come on. I don't mind if People does it. Or whatever, but Village Voice, they're supposed to be a serious, you know, they were once a voice of serious journalism. Or Rolling Stone, if they would do it, that would be awful. It's like, that's where you turn for serious rock journalism, serious reporting, not for slideshows of chicks.
But can I tell you something? The reason half the people, but the reason a lot of people go to Coachella is because there are
the music.
It's so darn hot that half the women are wearing like
they're not
nothing.
There. If they can go to a club, they can see. They're there for the music. They're not there to see people with their shirts off.
I don't know about that. I did hear one person say that they were disappointed.
There's cheaper ways to get your kicks.
Well, one person leaving Coachella on Friday night said it wasn't as wild and crazy as they had thought. They wanted to see a concert full of regret.
It's called Woodstock, and it happened a long, long time ago. So you're getting older now, Sperling. When your grandchildren say to you, hey, Grandpa, do you want to watch a TV show on our apps? Well, you know what the heck they're talking about.
I'm going to say, what'd you say? Apps? I don't know what you're talking about.
Explain it to us.
Well, an app, see, is software. It's short for application.
No. Explain to us what Netflix CEO Reed Hastings said.
Okay, so Reed Hastings, this head of... Netflix.
We're moving on to television.
That's right. We are moving on to television. You know, we bash these guys, Netflix, and Reed Hastings especially, because they
didn't.
Well, we kind of said, look, they're obviously not very
sure. They did a poor move, but there was we thought it was silly that people slammed them as if they had destroyed the world for, you know, doing the inevitable of splitting up the DVD and the streaming service. It was a logical step. They didn't need to drop their name. They did a little poorly, but they reacted smartly and swiftly, and there was no reason to suddenly decide their business was a disaster. So all these people who suddenly come back to the stock, now they're all happy again. They're just like lemmings.
Right. Well, you know, they really have turned the boat around. Record earnings.
Their stock price is about $212 per share. That's well below the peak price of $300. So yeah, they pulled it back up, but it's still, you know, 50% lower than it was at its peak. So let's not pop the champagne quite yet.
Well, everybody thought at $300 it was overpriced. So
fair enough. Good point.
You know, so $200, it's not $75, which is what it was during this whole melee of like, let's split the company up and rename half of it. And well, needless to say, earnings are up, and Reed Hastings is releasing this manifesto on the future of television and what he sees as the future of television. First thing he says, absolutely.
Well, wait a second. I just want to ask. When a CEO releases a manifesto on the industry, isn't that time that you should ask him to retire? When they start doing big think projects and putting out manifestos, that's probably the time you want them to step away from the company, don't you think?
I don't know. Jeffrey
Katzenberg. You know what I mean, though, don't you?
Oh, yes. You're talking about in the past all of the entertainment executives that have done that and either A, gotten fired, or B, moved on shortly thereafter.
Exactly.
So you have Reed Hastings, who's saying apps will replace channels. And really what he's trying to say is Internet Protocol Television, IPTV. TV over the internet. Now,
as opposed to getting your TV from cable or from satellite or from over the air onto an antenna.
Right. Now, what he really is saying by apps, I understand why he's using the word apps, because most
people... It's cool.
Well, it's trendy. It's like saying the word big data. I heard Chris Dodd use the word big data from the MPAA in his speech in talking about, well, I won't go into what he was talking about, but I just thought, did you just say big data? I mean, come on, how trendy of a term can that be?
They can't even get the big data of what ticket prices are, right? So I'm not going to turn to them for that.
Big data. In any case, you know, most people, when they're getting IPTV, I mean, you and I, Michael, we know how to get it. Well,
what do you mean? I don't get IPTV. I mean, I know how to go online and click on an app.
I was waiting for you to say the rest of that Lone Ranger joke. What do you mean, we, white man?
Oh, okay.
I had to explain that joke to somebody.
Well, that happens.
You know, anyway, did see part of the Lone Ranger, by the way. In any case.
I bet it looked awful.
You know, it could go either way.
No, it looks awful.
Okay.
No, it's not going to be a good film. There's no way.
So by apps.
So Reed Hastings, he says apps will replace channels, by which he means forget the cable companies and the satellite companies. People are going to be getting their television content over the internet, and they're going to be accessing it via services like the BBC app, the ESPN app, the HBO To Go app, things like that.
Right. Or, you know, if they're savvy enough, they'll go to BBC.com and like find where the video is.
Right.
So, but the app just kind of puts it all in one place, kind of condenses it a little bit, makes it a little bit easier for people who say have Apple TV or whatever they, whatever. Over
so
the
he
top
says he
that.
Has things like Netflix and ESPN and HBO and the BBC. Those are the leaders of the future. They're going to be more important than, say, ABC or CBS, because as people cut the cord or just get access via the internet, those are going to be the brands that are doing it right.
Right. Because what he's saying is, look, ESPN has an app and people watch it. HBO watch, you know, lets you watch online. Doesn't matter what time, I don't know, Game of Thrones is on. You can just go back and watch it whenever the heck you want. Same with BBC. Same with Netflix. We don't care. It's not linear. Linear television is what we've always had. It, you know, there's one thing on at 8 and another thing on at 9, and it's on channel 2, and it's CBS, and you kind of flick the channel up.
And that's been upended ever since the VCR to a degree, and it's gotten worse and worse as far as the networks are concerned. And he has a good point, but how does that play out? You're CBS, you make your money on ads. Who's going to pay for the programming if CBS can't show it with ads at 8 o'clock and get a big audience?
Well, first of all, a couple things. One, doesn't necessarily mean that you don't put ads up, okay? Now, HBO doesn't have ads. Netflix doesn't have ads. ESPN, when you're watching some of their I don't want to say apps, but some of their content online, they'll throw an ad at you. So they're
not
only...
Major League Baseball doesn't have ads, do they?
Oh, yes,
MLB?
They do. Yes,
oh,
they do.
All right. Okay.
They don't have local ads. It can get confusing sometimes how they run their ads. They're getting better at it, though.
Okay. So there will still be ads.
Yes, depending on, you know, which content provider, that's the best way to put it. Which content provider, Hulu, you'll get ads. Netflix, you won't.
So, but there have to be enough of these ads at these apps or these channels available online for someone to cut the cord. People like to complain about their cable bill. Mine's too high. But there is something to be said for easy and simple access to 700 channels. When I suddenly hear about a show on FX that I've never watched FX before, but suddenly someone says, oh, you should check out Archer, I can just go to there and call it up. Now, if I have to add a channel, it's a big pain in the neck. I have to call up the cable company, pay for an entire month of the service just to have that channel. And if I don't like it, I have to remember to call them up and cancel it again, or I'll pay for it next month. Maybe I have to buy another digital tier just to get that channel. So that can be a big, you know, annoyance. Is it possible that access to all these different channels like IFC or the Big Ten Sports Network or AMC will be easier if you're doing it online? Like maybe if you just get a show on an app, you'll be able to just watch a show and not have to pay for a big addition to your cable bill every month.
Precisely. Exactly. That's exactly right. What everything
and,
you just said
and of
is
course, you don't have to get on a tier. You know,
that's
you don't
right.
have to get on somebody's tier. Huffy did post, by the way, just got on a tier for Mark Cuban's cable channel system. Like, 6 hours a day on channel XXQRY 1742, something on his HDNet thing or whatever that is.
Yeah,
you know, Mark Cuban's got, like, who, my God, nobody's going to be watching that. They clearly will be getting a lot more people if they just go to HuffingtonPost.com and click on the videos.
That's true. That is very true.
Right. It's almost old school silly to bother to get on his tier on his tiny little cable thing that's available on a few channels, you know.
Right. And now, I guess, really, there wasn't very much news here because Reed Hastings has said most of this before, and anybody with, like, you know, eyes, a brain, and ears, it kind of knows the trend that's happening in the television space right now. But what I find interesting is that Netflix, in their earnings report and in their earnings call, said, hey, you know what? We had this deal with Viacom and we were paying a licensing fee for all this Viacom content. But you know what? Actually, not a lot of people were watching it. So we paid for all this content and it wasn't all that popular. It wasn't all that successful. So from now on, we're not going to be having a deal with Viacom. We're going to give that deal up.
The Netflix gravy train is over.
That's right. That's right. That's exactly where I was headed with this. And that's instead of doing this broad sweeping $200 million a year deal, what they're going to do is say, hey, we want SpongeBob SquarePants. We'll pay for that. And we'll pay for some Tom Cruise content and we'll pay for some Star Trek content. But that's it. We don't want, you know, I don't know, some movie that nobody saw in 1980.
Here's what I think. I think every channel, every app, whatever you want to call it, every website needs their own original special content. But if I'm selling content, I would be wary of doing big exclusive deals. I would much rather have my content on all sorts of different channels. Don't limit yourself to Netflix or whatever, you know, Time Warner Cable or whatever the person is that wants to have access to your video. You know, put it on Hulu, put it on Netflix, put on whoever's a gamer, get good money from all of them rather than going for a pricier exclusive deal because then people can't find your programming.
Well, you know what? That might work really for older catalog titles. However, for new content, there are output deals. You know, HBO is an output deal. Showtime is an output deal for some of these studios and they get paid. So, you know, they sell that window and that's how they go and make their movies.
Well,
at
well
least
they
in
make
part.
Their, that's for their own original content. But if HBO is buying a package of movies from Paramount, I'm saying Paramount would be stupid to say, oh, I'm going to sell all my movies to HBO and let them show them. I say, get some money from HBO, get some from Netflix, get some from Hulu, get some from anyone you can, but be wary of limiting your product to exclusive deals with certain channels.
Well, that's exactly what they do right now. They go and they say, okay, HBO, you have the premium cable window. I've sold that to you. That's my output deal. You'll get all my films because I'm Universal and I cut a deal with you.
Right. And I think that's dumb.
Well, that's the way the industry works right now.
I know. I think in the future, if you've got a TV show on CBS and you're going to go and do quote unquote syndication, you want it to be seen by as many as people as possible so that they can bring new people to the next season of your show. Say it's an active current show. So if you've got Revolution on NBC or whatever, that's maybe not a good choice. But you've got a new show, a new drama, a new sitcom. I wouldn't want to do an exclusive deal with Netflix. I'd want it to be seen on multiple channels as broadly as possible. So when someone says, I want to see that new CBS show, they don't have to remember, where do I go?
Well, that's part of the right now, that's part of the problem with IPTV. That is, it's like the Wild West. You never know where the
content is. Can we call it internet TV? IP is goofy.
Okay,
it's hard for me to know what it means. It sounds like IPTV.
Well, that's part of the problem is where the heck is this screening?
Right.
And by the way, it was screening at Hulu just last week, and now it's going to screen over at Yahoo because it's Saturday Night Live.
And that's a nightmare. Yeah, the Saturday Night Live, you know, or even old episodes of shows. Again, if I want to watch Leave It to Beaver, I shouldn't have to spend an hour trying to figure out where it's at.
Right.
And that's, again, the beauty of your cable system. You type in Leave It. I wanted to watch an episode of Happy Days for some obscure reason. We wanted to see how bad it was after the first 2 years. Not that it was great in the first 2 years, but, you know, it got really bad and cartoonish. And my roommate, I don't know, how bad was it? I type in Happy Days. So you got some reruns on some channel I never go to. Call it up. Boom. There you go.
Wow. That's pretty
awesome. I guess you can Google it, but that's another extra step where you don't have to think about it.
Well, I mean, I guess, you know, ultimately, what do you think of this? I mean, a lot of people are saying the manifesto, he said it all before, not big news.
It's certainly not a big, it's not a big deal. No.
Oh, what did you say? It's not a big deal. Well, then it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story. Hey, let's stick with television. What do you say?
Let's do it.
Fox and Univision are threatening to go cable. We talked about this. So during our last episode back in 2012, major TV networks are still weighing their options over the Aereo startup that allows people to stream over-the-air signals to their computers and laptops and TVs without having to pay for cable or satellite. Now, we talked about this again last episode, this big court ruling that was in Aereo's favor. The technical term for their reaction is, you know, if you were to, well, scientifically speaking, I believe it's called freaking out, actually. Fox and Univision say the company is a giant killer and insist they may have to turn themselves into a pure cable channel rather than going over the air if Aereo continues. That's just the most extreme reaction, and it's not a new one. I mean, we talked about that last week. Fox or any of these broadcast networks might take that. Networks have weighed the idea for years of turning themselves into a cable channel as a way of double dipping. That is, getting revenue from cable companies and ads, just like ESPN, HBO, and the rest. So they'll get the retransmission fee and the advertising money. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I would say the threat from Fox and Univision is a big whoop.
What?
Well, Barry Diller put this, you know, shot this down very, very tightly.
He now, said, Barry Diller is an investor in Aereo, so...
Yes. But yeah. Nonetheless, if he speaks the truth, he speaks the truth. And he says, give me a break. Local TV stations are a huge source of revenue for the networks. And the idea that they're going to go cable and leave all the local stations, their cash cows, high and dry with no content and no reason for anyone to show them is hogwash. And frankly, he has a good point.
Well, not only that, there's spectrum issues. There's a whole bunch of issues that
would
come.
Oh, my God. And, you know, if you're going to go to internet TV, IPTV, make sure your cable provider has a nice fat pipeline and make sure you're not going to have caps on your monthly usage. Because that's all they want to do is give you caps and charge you more for more usage and dial you down and slow you up once you start watching a lot of video. We all need like terabyte.
That's why
internet. We need Google to come to every town in America.
Well, that's why, you know, these caps were put into place because the internet service providers kind of see this happening. The internet service providers, who, by the way, are cable.
Right.
You know,
right.
The cable providers. They see this and they kind of go, so we're going to lose our cable subscribers because they're all going to go to internet within the next 20 years.
It's as if we all had phones and had free local calls and they saw we're making all these local calls and they said, enough of that.
Right, precisely. Now, our next story is about Paramore. And if you don't know Paramore, Paramore is a band. They debuted at number one on the Billboard Top 200 album charts. Country star Brad Paisley's new album debuted at number two.
This was 2 weeks ago.
Yes. So this is news that is old. So I'm going to go with big whoop on this. Anyway, Justin Timberlake dropped to number three. And hold on a second. I don't think actually there is no more music. There is no more music. There's just those three from 2 weeks ago.
No.
We don't know anything else because this week Billboard decided to put its singles and album charts behind a paywall. Why? Probably because it worked so well for Variety. They looked at Variety and said, whoa, we should do that too. No, wait. Actually, this just applies to Billboard Biz, I believe. Is this a big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Yeah, so what happened was, it took us a while to figure it out, but if you go to billboard.com to look at their news music industry stuff and see their charts, great. I always switch to the Billboard Biz logo because I like the layout better. It's easier to follow what's going on, and I don't need to see what rock stars went to the beach this summer and what bathing suit they wore. Thank you, Billboard. But anyway, I went there, and when you went to Billboard Biz and click on a chart, they only showed you the first three ones and said, hey, you got to sign up and, you know, subscribe if you want to see more. And I was like, oh, my God. How stupid are they? That didn't work for Variety. It's a horrible idea. It's the only thing bringing traffic to your site. But it turns out it's only if you're on the Billboard Biz version of the website. If you're on the one geared toward the mainstream public, they show you the entire charts. Maybe not all of them, maybe not the history, but if you want to see the new charts, the Hot 100, the top 200 albums, you can do it if you go to billboard.com. But if you go to Billboard Biz, which is presumably people in the industry, they're like, oh, now you have to pay. As if people are so dumb, they're not going to know to just switch over to the other version.
Well,
bizarre.
You just
idiotic.
Said you didn't know where to find the internet TV.
Right. All they did was drive me away. They didn't get me to pay.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Speaking of being driven away, while HBO's Game of Thrones continues to grow in its third season, hitting record highs in viewers, AMC's Mad Men remains, well, again, we're going to use a scientific word, moribund. The season premiere hit 3.4 million viewers in the overnight ratings, and by the third episode, it had tumbled some 30% to 2.4 million viewers. So is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Big whoop.
I agree.
It's never been a big show commercially. It's never had always more press and articles than actual viewers. And it's just as true now as it was before. Creatively, I haven't liked the show since season two, but I seem to be alone in that.
Yeah, you know, I think it's always had more of the public.
Buzz.
Yeah, that's true. Well, now, speaking of buzz, okay, that was a really poor segue because, frankly, this has nothing to do with buzz. But, you know, talk about
a deal. Well, they're trying to create buzz.
Yeah, that's true. And that's exactly what they're doing. You're right. Thank you very much for saving my segue. Ooh, that should be the name of a show. Save my segue. Anyway, talk about a deal with the devil. The indie film company Cinedigm, and they're not really an indie film company. They are a digital cinema company. They are an integrator. They're more of a technology company that's becoming an indie film company. In any case, they have partnered with this little company called BitTorrent. Yes, BitTorrent, the site best known for helping its 170 million users upload and download large files, aka Hollywood movies, TV shows, albums, and books. Cinedigm is working with the site to promote the film, or I guess the technology, since it's not only a website, but they're promoting the film Arthur Newman, starring Colin Firth and Emily Blunt. BitTorrent will encourage its users to check out a 7-minute preview of the movie they can watch before the movie debuts in theaters. I guess it's this weekend. And this is a quote. "We've got this wonderful network of 170 million passionate consumers."
AKA pirates.
Yeah, I was like, consumers? Yeah, they're consuming content for free. So that's said by Matt Mason, the vice president of marketing over at BitTorrent. He told that to the LA Times. He says, "We view this as an opportunity to connect content creators with their fans, which, by the way, you've been doing since your inception in 2001. It's just that nobody's been making any money. In any case.
No, they buy more books and movies when they go to use BitTorrent. Anyway.
Big deal or big whoop?
It's not a big deal, but it's a logical deal. It's overdue. They've got 170 million people on their site at one time or another. Why wouldn't you want to reach that audience? You may be encouraging them. I guess the idea is Hollywood's upset because they think you're telling them to steal the movie opening weekend. But they're thinking, all right, these people do also probably, if they're really that passionate to steal, probably do also go to the movies, watch TV, buy music. So, hey, on the off chance that we can reach them and get them to come to our movie, let's experiment and see how it works. I think it's worth doing.
You see, I think this is kind of silly because these are people that are already downloading content illegally.
But so, don't you net people always argue that the ones who are that passionate also buy a lot?
Yeah, sometimes they do, actually. Sometimes they do. I don't think they're going to be running around looking for only 7 minutes of a movie, though.
No. They're just saying, hey, here's the first 7 minutes. If you're interested, maybe you'll go see it opening weekend. It's like an extended trailer.
Right.
Yeah. Why would you show a trailer on BitTorrent?
Yeah, absolutely.
But what's the difference? Aren't you just saying, hey, here's our movie. We know you like to steal a lot of movies. Why don't you pay for one?
Well, it's like the MPAA's Check the Box campaign that they announced at CinemaCon that more clearly states what the lurid the content in the
why
film.
A movie's rated R or PG-13.
Right, exactly.
Got sex, we've got violence, we've got...
Right, when the Atlantic Monthly or Atlantic Online said, hey, really that's just kind of advertising to the children which movies they should go see.
Yeah, that was in response to the violence, the tragic shooting. And they said, well, all right, we'll label films even more clearly as a sort of a sop to people who felt like they aren't doing enough to curb violence in film.
Right. Which, you know, ironically, I don't think is going to curb violence in film. In any case, David Mamet, you know him, right?
Playwright, author, film director. Absolutely.
Yes. Well, apparently publishing ebooks on your own isn't just for housewives anymore. A trend that began with amateur romance and sci-fi writers is now hitting the big time. Playwright and author David Mamet's new book is going to be published by, that's right, the House of David Mamet. He's going to do it himself. His agency, ICM, offers a self-publishing service, and Mamet is taking advantage of it for a novella and two short stories on war.
There's a lot of cursing.
You think? Maybe? Just a little? Well, he told the New York Times, quote, "Basically, I am doing this because I am a curmudgeon." Expletive. No, just kidding.
I'm an effing curmudgeon.
Yeah. Mr. Mamet said, "And because publishing is like Hollywood, nobody ever does the marketing they promise. Authors automatically," and now that ends the quote, "authors automatically get a higher percentage of the sale when self-publishing, and big names like Mamet can negotiate even better terms. Of course, they forego in advance, which Mamet does not need, so what's the point? ICM says it's not just new releases. Backlist titles are also being self-published, offering Searching for Bobby Fischer by Fred, how do you pronounce that name? Waitzkin?
Yeah.
And Ghosts of Mississippi by Marion Vollers as examples. Big deal? Big whoop? What's the deal?
I think Mamet is actually a big whoop, because a novella and two short stories as a package is a product that is absolutely of no interest to a major publisher. It's an awkward thing. It's perfect for an ebook to be self-published because it's not something that really is going to sell well in hardcover or as a big push. It's an awkward beast, a novella and two short stories. It's not a collection of short stories. It's not a novel. It's sort of just an odd little duck. And so it's perfect that it has an outlet. He thinks this is the way he wants to prepare and offer this piece on war. And this is what he wants to do. Great. And that's a great way to experiment and make a novella and things like that available via the internet and ebooks. I think that's great. What should worry publishers is the sort of things they mentioned at the end. Oh, yeah, and we're doing some backlist titles. Searching for Bobby Fischer, which became a feature film, and Ghosts of Mississippi also inspired a feature film. Those are valuable, best-selling backlist titles. And that's where the publishers make a lot of their money. So when those are going the self-publishing route, that's when they have to really worry, because they spend all their money and time throwing a bunch of books out into the world. 300,000 books a year get published by the big publishers, and only a tiny, tiny percentage of them become hits. And those hits, over the years, if they're lucky, become a valuable backlist. And that's where they really make their dough. And that's going to the internet, and that's going to be self-published. Then they're really in trouble.
Well, now, David Mamet, we usually associate with theater. And right now, the theater world is on high alert. All the annual theater awards come out now because, for some reason, the theater season runs from the fall through the spring. Forget about summer. Off-Broadway awards are coming fast and furious, including the Drama Desk nominations this morning, which showered love on the terrific off-Broadway musical Giant, David Byrne's musical Here Comes Love, and Broadway fare like Matilda. The Tony Award nominations happen on Tuesday after we record. You can be sure Matilda will get a lot of love, but you can also be sure it won't score a nod in one key category, and that is Best Actress. That's because the four little girls who rotate in the role of Matilda were deemed ineligible and will instead receive a special Tony honor in recognition of their work. It's called a paycheck, actually. That's the special honor. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal for the other women who will be nominated for Best Actress, because now they have a chance.
That's true.
Of actually winning, because the girls, not the same girls, but the team of girls won the Best Actress Award at the Olivia Awards last year. So, you know, they were going to have a good shot at winning it this year. I can understand how it's a little weird. You could not ever have everybody see all four girls, and therefore they would be voting on people that they hadn't even seen perform. So it's an odd duck. It's something you have to do, like in Billy Elliot or this, when you have a young child performer carrying a big show. They can't do 8 shows a week. I think it's a reasonable compromise. It's hard now, because then when do you decide not to honor the little kiddies when they're in a Broadway show? You know, then you're saying your show sucked. You know, I think it was a reasonable choice, given the vagaries of how they're handling this. And believe me, if you're a woman in a musical, you just went, ooh, thank goodness. Now Laura Osnes and Cinderella has a shot.
Well, now, speaking of theater awards, and you mentioned the Olivier Awards theater, Helen Mirren pulled off a rare trick in London over the weekend. She won an Olivier Award, the UK equivalent of the Tony, for playing Queen Elizabeth. Of course, Mirren won an Oscar for playing the same historical figure. That's somewhat rare, but what makes it even more trivia-worthy is the fact that she won awards for playing the same historical figure in two different shows. Actors often recreate their stage role for film, but to play someone like Queen Elizabeth in The Queen, and then in the stage play, the audience, which is the name of the play there, is very, very rare. Other big winners include the smash stage production of the best-selling novel The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nightmare Time. And that is one title.
Don't you know, that was a big bestseller about a kid with autism. You don't know that book?
The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime? No.
Huge, huge popular bestseller in America. Huge, big, big book.
Was it written by George Jones?
It was not.
Okay, just checking, because I didn't know him either. Anyway, a musical revival of Sweeney Todd starring Imelda Staunton also was a big winner. Both are almost certain to come to New York pretty soon. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop. I think Helen Mirren basically strode, you know, onto stage in the role, right off the stage into the Olivier Awards. It was almost a given that she was going to win, because she just owns this part. She's a great actress, a great theater actress as well. And she just did a great job in the role. It's not a great play by all standards, by everything I've heard, but she's just very winning in it. And it's kind of, you're in England. They feel like they got to award the queen practically. So it was almost a given that she would win it, but it's still, it's a very fun trivia note. And I'm very excited for the shows. The Curious Incident, I've heard, is just wonderful, really clever production, and I'm really looking forward to seeing that in New York sometime soon.
The actress known professionally as Junie Hwang, and I hope I did not mispronounce that, well, she lost her lawsuit against IMDb. We've talked about this in the past. The 42-year-old performer claimed she lost work because it posted her real age and that IMDb violated its own agreement by using info she provided to sign up for IMDb Pro in order to track down her real age. IMDb demonstrated in court that she had provided fake documents, lied, and misrepresented herself, claiming to be a third party, a fake birth certificate, and so on. in order to dupe them into posting inaccurate information about her birth date. So basically all of this stuff is very Hollywood. In any case, she also had trouble demonstrating lost work since her film career is modest, and financial information that was provided show she often had expenses equal to her income, at least for tax purposes. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. It's kind of a very interesting case with a lot of weird ramifications. I mean, she basically fell apart in court because she wanted them to lie. It wasn't that she said, I don't want to be on there at all, and I don't want information up there. She was trying to get them to put up inaccurate information. So that's where her, and she, of course, she lied 8 Ways to Sunday about that information. That's where she lost her case. A good test case would have been someone who never wanted to be on IMDb or never provided personal information and asked them not to include any information, something like that, proactively said, please don't include me on there. Because there are people on IMDb where you don't see their ages and you don't see any personal info at all. I don't know how they get it to start with. And if you're a big star and you're in a bunch of movies and TV shows, they're going to list you whether you want it or not. And in this day and age, trying to pretend you can't find out whether someone was in high school and when becomes almost impossible. So you're going to know their age within a couple years, you know, of 2 or 3 years of what their actual age is. It's just, you know, hard to avoid. Nonetheless, when you're on there and you want to be on there, but you want them to lie about your age, that's just untenable. But you saw Amazon was at the lawsuit. They were there in court taking notes because for them, as an online person that provides a lot of information, it was a really important case to them. Google was there. They all lined up behind IMDb because they found it very
awkward. Well, first of all, Amazon owns IMDb. That's why Amazon was
there. Yeah, but the Amazon General Counsel came in and sat in on the trial.
Well, Amazon owns IMDb.
They were there because they know how it affects Amazon and all these sites. Google took a stand on the case. They backed up IMDb because the idea that you need to lie or hide people's personal information. I'm sorry, if they're a public figure, they're in movies, TV shows, you decide they're a public figure, you want to put info about them to be sued because you had accurate information about someone online. That's a very scary proposition.
Well, now, if you're a public figure, you know what becomes a lot easier?
What?
Raising money. In fact, has Veronica Mars started a serious trend? In the wake of the Veronica Mars movie finally getting off the ground via a Kickstarter campaign, we talked about that, I guess, a week or two or three or four ago, actor Zach Braff, you might remember him from Scrubs, he has launched a similar campaign, a Kickstarter campaign, to fund the sequel to his hit film Garden State, which, you know, 9 years ago is when that film was released. Braff spent years trying to get the project made, but it always involved a loss of control, like casting or losing Final Cut. Near the end, he was so desperate he was ready to cast someone's brother and give up Final Cut if it meant he could get the film made. But now...
He was joking when he said that. Yes,
yeah. But now, Wish I Was Here, which is the name of the film, is looking to raise $2 million in 2 days. It raised $1.5 million on Kickstarter. And actually...
It's all done. In 2 days, he basically did it. That was like a day and a half. He had 1.5 million. So he's done. Success.
Yeah. I mean, last night when I checked, 30,686 backers pledging $2.1 million.
And he stopped accepting money.
He did?
Yeah. He closed it. As soon as he hit 2 million, he was closing it off.
Oh, really? Okay.
That's my understanding. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, he wasn't trying to get us, unlike Veronica Mars, where they said the more money we raise, the bigger we can do. He said, I want 2 million.
Right. Well, if it happens, and it is, this will be Graf's first directorial feature since Garden State 9 years ago. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. I think it's bizarre he couldn't get a deal done. Don't you? I mean, I'm sure he wasn't asking for the moon. It's a passion project. It wasn't like he said, I want to, you know, have first dollar gross and I want a $10 million fee. And Garden State was a successful film, made good money. I just can't understand how he couldn't get a deal made.
Well, it's one thing to make a movie the way he did with Garden State, where effectively
one expected anything. Yeah,
right. And one investor basically made the movie for him.
Right, but then it was a success. So if I'm a studio, why wouldn't you want to, for a dime, be in business with Zach Braff and give him $4 million, $5 million to make a movie?
Well, that's just unfortunately not the way Hollywood works. Everybody wants to have their say, and everybody.
None of the indies. Nobody wanted. But no. Come on. What do you mean? You wouldn't make a deal with him?
Well,
unless he said it's a film about ant farms and no one's going to speak the entire film except Esperanto, you know, unless it's some crazy nutty idea.
Well, again, we haven't read the script, so we don't know. So maybe that was one way.
You don't trust him?
Again,
he made that movie. He wrote the script. So we're going to assume it's not lunatic. It's a romantic comedy drama. It's not about him being a child molesting clown. It's a film about love.
Well, he got a lot of flack for this, you know. He got a lot of flack for this.
For what?
For launching this Kickstarter campaign.
Why?
Because a lot of people felt like, hey, you're a big star from Scrubs. You should have, like, millions of dollars. Just put $2 million in yourself. And Zach Braff was like, look, I'm not made of Oprah money, okay? I don't just have millions of dollars lying around. And so I think this is perfectly fine. If Zach Braff, as a filmmaker, wants to go out and try to raise money on his own, the problem that I have with it is these are dumb investments, meaning they're blind.
Well, they're not investments. They're not investments. People are just saying...
You're absolutely right.
They're not investments. They're saying, oh, you can give me a t-shirt and a script and put my name in the credits. Cool. That's it.
They're not
investing in the movie.
You're absolutely
It's sad and pathetic, of course, that this is not the future of filmmaking. This is very unusual circumstances where you get this movie or Veronica Mars made because you have such an ardent fan base for that particular project. You can get them to just give you money. But they're not investors.
No, not at all. Not in the slightest.
I think it's a big deal.
Okay. Well, I guess we have a ton of stories we could continue on, but we are running long, so maybe we should move on to Inside Baseball.
All right.
And that's where we analyze some of the headlines.
How do you say hello in Cantonese?
I have no idea. I don't even know how to say Inside Baseball in Cantonese or how to tell people, or Mandarin, thank you. That Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. I don't know how this will affect everybody, but it certainly affected a bunch of people in China. And in fact, China will be our topic for Inside Baseball. It's China, China, and more China, as it has been in the past. I guess Django Unchained, if you're not familiar, it's a Quentin Tarantino movie.
Mm-hmm.
Nominated for Academy Award.
By the way, Li Ho. Li Ho, Sperling. That's how you say hello in Cantonese.
I thought it was Ni Hao.
You can say Ni Hao as well. Li or Ni. It depends.
Okay.
Ni is more classical, I think, where Li is more casual. You hear that a lot in Hong Kong, I think.
Okay.
Li Hao.
Okay. You know what you don't hear in Hong Kong? You don't hear the soundtrack to Quentin Tarantino's movie Django Unchained because it started playing in movie theaters after its release in China. And like 5, 10, 15 minutes in, the plug was yanked. And all the people watching the movie had to leave.
There were midnight showings on a Thursday night, and people saw the whole film. Come Friday morning, the movie was officially allowed to be released. It was put in theaters. They had midnight screenings on Thursday. People saw the movie. People showed up for the first screening on Friday morning, 10 a.m., and then suddenly the lights went on, the movie stopped, and the guy said, oh, we have technical problems, you have to leave. And they yanked the film in the middle of its first day of release. Bizarre.
Yeah.
And then people said, this is crazy. I'm so embarrassed to be Chinese. I'm going to go online and watch a pirate version right now.
That's right. So they all went and pirated the movie. So congratulations. You know, here's the thing. I think Hollywood is beginning to realize just how hard it is to work with China. And we should say, before we leave Django Unchained, Chris Dodd was asked about this at CinemaCon during a panel on, of all places, China. And he said, I don't know what happened with that. I have no idea. I'm thinking, wait, you've been back and forth to China how many times since you took over this job at the MPAA, and you have no idea what happened to one of the 34 movies that's allowed to play from, you know, from outside China in the country. And you have no idea.
He was on the phone the first minute it happened.
Yeah,
sure.
You have no idea what happened. And so now they made, first of all, the release that was, you know, that played that one night, it was censored already. And now Quentin Tarantino had to go back and recut it again, so a second time, to get it released, and it's being released, I guess, this weekend.
Well, so we'll see.
We'll see, yeah.
So it's. I think it's a big sprawling bureaucracy. It's a totalitarian one-state government. It's a big sprawling bureaucracy, and sometimes the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing. Somebody approved it, and then somebody else said, what? And, you know, put their foot down and said no. So it's hard to do business there. Hollywood just wants a piece of that pie, and they're willing to do whatever they can to get in there. They want more movies shown in China, and they want to take more box office out of China back home again. And so they're bending over backwards to accommodate the country.
Right. And what they're finding out is they think they're accommodating the country, but they're really not, because there are no rules. So this whole idea of a Chinese co-production, which will allow a studio to take more money of the country, or it will allow the studio to release a film against, let's see, nobody, because the Chinese film group, which releases movies there, will basically not release any other movies for films that it is that it helps co-produce. What they're finding out is they think they're co-producing a movie. They think their movie is a co-production, but in the end it's not, because there are no rules. There's nothing that's written down. So it just becomes this really big mess that's hard to navigate.
So let's go over some of the key details. We'll trade off. I'll go first. China is the second biggest film market in the world. They have $2.7 billion in grosses in 2012. And by all estimates, they will pass the U.S. in 7 years.
Well, and there are only 34 foreign films allowed to be shown in China. That is a number that will be changing, no doubt, because they are building movie theaters there as if somehow their life depended on it.
That's right. Oh, but no matter if your movie's shown in China, you're not going to get a lot of money out of it because only 20 to 25% of the box office actually makes it out of the country back to the distributor or the studio that made it. And that's probably the lowest percentage in the world.
Right. And that's the 20 to 25% of the box office growth that is reported by the theater owners.
So, and they need to get their money before they give it to the government.
Yeah, I made a dollar. I mean, 50 cents. Here you go. Well, anyway, China's goal is to...
Your ticket, by the way, is 50 cents, but your bag of popcorn, which you must buy, is $5.
Right. A lot of people are saying this, that China's out there just trying to soak up Hollywood as much as possible and then create its own industry with movies that they can play around the world. They're trying to, like, basically become Hollywood and figure out how that was done.
Well, and they have a great base in Hong Kong because they have a great film industry there that has, you know, it's the third biggest creator of films in the world at one point. I don't know what they're doing right now, but it was India, Hollywood, and then Hong Kong as far as making movies, and they make world-class films. I wonder if they plan to make films in English.
We'll see. Probably not. I don't know. But you know what I find interesting is they think, whoever wrote that, I guess it was in the Hollywood Reporter, they believe that somehow they're going to be able, and that is China, China's going to somehow begin kind of working with a group on manufacturing a product and then somehow take it over? I mean, come on. There's no way they could do that.
Well, but Hollywood is, you know, the creative industry is difficult, and that's where you gain a lot by being in democracy. When you're in China and you're trying to create art, there's a lot of problems. You've had filmmakers who've come up against walls, they get censored, they get pushed back down. Even if you're trying to make something commercial, you've got people second-guessing you, it can't reflect poorly on the country. It's very hard to navigate all that and make stuff. That's why a lot of Chinese filmmakers either have to kowtow to the government too much, it's kowtow, Japanese term, I may be wrong, but they have to, placate the government too much, they end up sort of hurting their career, or they leave and go to the West. It's not an industry like building a car where, you know, there are no arguments about the screw into the bolt into the car. You know, it's difficult to make a movie.
That is
especially
true.
Especially when you've got a lot of clamp down on freedom and censorship and all that. You've got a huge burgeoning middle class. You've got a growing free press. You've got sort of a growing court system. But believe me, it's still a one-party state.
Well, and I love what one executive told The Hollywood Reporter. And this is a quote. China is way too big to ignore and way too effed up to expect anything.
I bet he didn't say exactly that.
I'm pretty sure. Yeah, you're probably right.
And now, who's the best at navigating China's waters? Who's doing the best job of all the Hollywood studios? DreamWorks Animation. They're not a studio, of course. They're a shingle. I don't know what you would call them now. But anyway, they've released a dozen films in China. That's got to be practically the best of anybody. They're building a production facility in Shanghai, and Kung Fu Panda 3 will be a co-production, the first animated film to do so.
Right. It's a little bit easier with animated films because the storylines are somewhat generic, or I don't want to say generic, but they're not as
universal fairy tale.
Yes, exactly. It's not like, oh, we have some bad guys who are Chinese. Oh, well, now we can't be a Chinese co-production. Make them North Korean. You know, it's a little bit more of a clear cut line with animated films.
So they fire hundreds of employees. The CEO gets a huge raise and they move their next big film over to China.
Welcome to Hollywood.
I'm done kicking DreamWorks Animation. I'm going to leave off them for a week or two.
Okay, well, you know, if you have any thoughts about China, or frankly, any of the stories we've discussed on today's show, you can find those stories, just in case you want to read some of them yourself, on our website, showbizsandbox.com. Now, that's also where you will find ways to contact us. You can email us, and our email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. If you're going to be in Cannes for the film festival in May, definitely drop us a line and let us know, and we'll try to arrange a meetup there. So we went over how to contact us. We went over how to read the stories. You know, you can subscribe to the show. You can subscribe in iTunes, the Zune Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere that podcasts are aggregated, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can find our podcast there, and we do encourage you to subscribe, to rate and review the show at those outlets, those aggregators, it does help us out. Of course, you can follow us on Twitter. Our username is @ShowbizSandbox. We're also on Facebook, where we have a page, and you can like us. It's facebook.com/ShowbizSandbox. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found not at Coachella this year, but maybe next year. But they can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael, you have a website. What is it?
It is michaelgiltz.com. I'm blanking here.
Oh, my goodness. Usually, Michael
I was looking up how to say goodbye in Cantonese.
You know, you got to pay attention to the show, you know, when
That's
you're doing
it. Right.
Well, some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, and this time we do mean next week, play nice.